This is Norfolk Works, and I'm Hazel Kahn. Today, my guest is Abra Morovic, the co-founder of Feisty Acres Farm, and they buy and sell birds of all kinds for people to eat, along with their eggs. And I interviewed Abra actually over a year ago on a wonderful interview, a spontaneous one, driving around in her red truck and listening to all the birds clucking. By birds, we mean enumerate your birds.
Oh, yeah. Quail, guinea hens, partridge, heritage chickens, heritage ducks, heritage turkeys.
Don't you have partridge?
Yes, we do. We do chucker partridge.
Chucker partridge. The point is it's birds. And,
yes.
And you've discovered a unique and profitable niche. And I don't know if you did it intentionally or if you fell upon it.
It was definitely intentional and also fallen upon, I guess, if you want to get technical, because while I was working for other farms out here on the North Fork and going to markets, I had worked for another poultry farmer, and I used to go to market for them, and they just sold chickens, two different kinds of chickens. And at the markets, I always had people asking me for other types of poultry and game birds. I used to get asked for quail very often, pheasant, partridge, turkey. And so when a bunch of people keep asking you for these birds over and over and over again, it kind of turns a light on. And so we started with quail back in 2015, and then we grew upon raising quail. We introduced French guinea hens and partridge, and we did different kinds of chickens. And it's grown into something quite different than what we had in 2015. So we're pretty proud, Chris and I.
And now you can be even prouder because you've added sheep, are they called, or goats? You've now got one of those, right?
Yes, we have five goat kids right now. They're Boer goats. They're a South African breed of goat. We're kind of just dabbling in it at the moment. We are more interested in having them as seasonal grazers. So instead of using, say, a fuel-powered tractor to mow, which is actually very important in pasture maintenance, we're trying to do less of that throughout the season. And goats are a very efficient way to graze a pasture, especially one like ours that has a lot of undesirable weeds such as mugwort and poison ivy. Goats eat all of those things. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of going to be a perfect fit for us. And yes, the end of the year, the idea is that we will be harvesting them for meat.
And in the meantime, they're also fertilizing your pasture.
Yes, they're fertilizing it. They're aerating it with their hooves. And we are following the goat pasture and paddock with our birds. And so our birds will further enrich the pasture after the goats, because they'll pick through the goat's manure, they'll pick through any bugs or insect eggs that might be in there, and they will kind of finish foraging through the pasture and fertilizing the pasture behind the goats. So it's like a 1-2 system that we're going to be using this year instead of just the poultry.
The reason I called you right now is after there was an article in the New York Times last weekend about what they call the surprising boom that small farms in New York are experiencing. And I wanted to ask you if you're surprised.
I am absolutely surprised. Chris, my partner, he was following the development of COVID-19 back in December and January. And we were pretty worried that if it did come to the United States and people had to quarantine or lock down, we were very worried about being able to continue to go to farmers markets and sell to our customers. Grow NYC operates all the green markets in New York City. And Mayor de Blasio of New York City basically made an argument that these farmers markets, they're all open air, are vital access points for people in New York City to get food. So people who are in the Bronx or people who are in Brooklyn who maybe live in a food desert can actually go to a local farmers market run by Grow NYC that pops up in their neighborhood once or twice a week, and they have access to actually good, affordable, nutritious food.
Were you deemed essential workers?
Agriculture is deemed an essential business here in New York and also all across the United States because, let's be honest here, people have to eat. if we were to shut down and if we weren't able to sell food directly to customers, people would have a harder time accessing food. So let's think for a minute, a person who lives in a neighborhood in New York City, and let's say you're in quarantine and lockdown and you don't really want to go on the subway or you don't want to go on the bus to go to the grocery store that's a couple neighborhoods over. You're able to still go to your farmer's market and actually get food in an open air environment. You know, it helps to cut down on the risk of transmission of COVID-19. Have to wear a mask in order to enter any of the green markets at the bare minimum, but a lot of customers also wear gloves and are always hand sanitizing. And then all the vendors, such as myself, we have to wear masks, we have to wear gloves, we have to handle products separately than money. All of our products, we have to be prepackaged at the farm. And we have to constantly be sanitizing our booths and our tables. So because we were deemed essential businesses and the green market was deemed essential, we were able to stay open. And that really allowed Chris and I and our farm to be able to survive basically what's going on and more than survive, thrive, which was extraordinarily surprising for us.
Why was the New York Times reporter surprised about this? The surprising boom. I'm wondering if it's because of all the stories we've been hearing about the dire situation that many of Europe's farms are going through.
From my understanding and reading the article, I think that Charity wanted to highlight the fact that the shorter the distance of the food between your plate, the more sustainable that farm business is or that food business is going to be. And for a lot of people, that might seem surprising because the vast majority of people aren't going to a farmer's market to buy food. But it seems as though that is changing, at least for now. I'm hoping that this change to buy direct from farmers isn't a flash in the pan. When the restaurants shut down and 40% of food, from my understanding, I could be wrong about that percentage number, but 40% of food grown in the United States usually ends up being brokered through wholesalers to restaurants. So when the restaurant industry closed, a lot of people who were producing farm products for restaurants were kind of left high and dry. It's very difficult when you're a very large operation or even a medium-sized operation or a small-sized operation. We have some small farmers here that are having a hard time pivoting from wholesale to retail because they just never had to cultivate those markets. And so that's why we're seeing images of those pigs and those piglets being euthanized. That's why we're seeing mountains of potatoes being dumped, milk being dumped, because farmers are not able to get their product to the customer, either because they can't get it freighted there or the storage that they usually are storing their product is full. That's another thing, too, is a lot of this food that usually goes to restaurants is kind of at a standstill and is in storage right now.
And the storage capacity is extremely inadequate to the task.
That's correct. That's correct. And so that's, I think, the heart of the issue. And it really highlights how centralized our food system is here in the United States and also in Europe and across much of the Western world. Very interesting. You have now distributors such as Baldor. They are now offering home delivery rather than just wholesale delivery to, like, let's say, grocery stores and restaurants. So they're changing a little bit of their business plan. They're offering home delivery. There's a couple of other large wholesalers that are doing the same.
They have the transportation to do that. They own the trucks. They just don't have the frame of mind or the hands to do the packaging, maybe.
That's right. And I mean, think about having to revamp their website. Yes, buy all of the packaging, having to hire additional workers just to be on a packing line, and then also hiring drivers that know certain neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a whole other ballgame. And I think some farmers are having to struggle with that as well. I know that we were struggling with it because we had a huge increase in demand of people who wanted pre-packaged pre-orders to pick up at the farm. And we actually were doing it for a while, But when I go to market in New York City, so when Chris is left by himself at the farm, not only does he have to take care of like a couple thousand birds, but then for 2 hours out of his day, he has to sit around and wait for people to come and pick up their packages that they ordered. And, you know, that just wasn't sustainable for us as a two-person operation. So we actually had to shut down our local pickups. We don't even have enough product to sustain one farmer's market in New York City. The product that we're producing right now at this very moment, at the same time last year, was enough to cover two farmers markets in New York City, my Union Square market and my Grand Army Plaza market in Brooklyn. I'm now down to one market once a week because I now sell two markets worth of product in one market day. Earlier this season, when, you know, Dookie was hitting the fan, Chris and I made the decision to actually purchase a surplus of chicks for laying eggs and for meat so that we could actually expand our business a little bit for the summer season and the fall and winter season so that we actually could pick up our second market again. And in fact, we'll be able to pick up our second market again late June, early July. But, you know,
that's because you now have more chicks and they've started laying and so on.
That's correct. Yes. So in February, when we started to get worried about this perhaps becoming a problem here in the United States, Chris and I went ahead and bought hundreds of chicks for laying eggs and for meat so that within 4 or 5 months, we would be able to provide more product for people to be able to purchase from us. You just got to figure it out. We're all just trying to figure this out.
That's all a direct consequence of the pandemic? Or is it an extension of what you were doing anyway, your model?
It's definitely an extension. We are just now expanding at a slightly quicker rate than we had planned to. In 2020, we had actually planned on plateauing our numbers maybe for two seasons just to catch up on, you know, certain expenses and stuff like that. But it's time to make sure that people who are interested in becoming more aware of their local food system and becoming a part of it, it's important that people have access to local product in order to become a part of that system. So we're doing our best to make sure that we're providing healthy, affordable eggs and poultry for people who want it and, you know, don't necessarily want to go to the grocery store anymore and want to support somebody who's growing local food.
But are you also thinking of yourselves as setting examples for the rest of the farmers of the North Fork, let's say, of the local food businesses? I mean, I know that that never... might, you might answer that and sound incredibly arrogant, but that I assure you it's not intended to be that way. I just wonder, let's put it another way. You also have to work in sync with all the other farmers, because in the end, we're talking about geography. We're talking about farms on actual land, on the equivalent of bricks and mortar. Everybody's on the same land. There is only a market if you're all in the market together.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, we farm with an idea and a system that works for us and for our piece of land and for our business model and for our birds. What we do is definitely not suitable for everybody's business. And so we're kind of offering up an example of what you could do if this is what you would want to do in terms of pasture-raised poultry and, you know, an interest in heritage breeds. But you know, you don't have to do it our way. There are so many ways in which you can do, you know, something similar to what it is that we're doing and be successful and also be responsible. But yes, as farmers, it's very important for us to farm together and take care of the land together because farms are like a legacy. And when you create a farm, you're not just farming for yourself, but you're perhaps farming maybe for your children or for younger people in the community who might want to take over your farm. And so there's something about that too. Growing food for people and respecting the land is also a part of our legacy as a community here on the North Fork.
Yeah, that's interesting that you're conscious of that. Sometime or other during the day, you might have that thought, right? It's not just a strategic idea. It's a living idea. To go back to the idea that you all have to do this together, I mean, people may come to you for birds and for eggs, but they go to someone else for potatoes or for vegetables or for fruit. So if somebody really wants to get a whole meal's worth for their family from local farmers, they have to go to 5 or 6 or 7 different locations, let's say on the North Fork. Being very parochial, we're talking about the North Fork right now.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and you know what? That's actually how it used to be, even in the city. But the beauty of the North Fork is that not only beautiful, so when you are driving from place to place, you have a wonderful scenery. You can go to Wickham's Fruit Farm for your fruit. You can go to Feisty Acres for your game birds. Sepp's for vegetables. Go to Tecklude Farm for raw milk. I mean, we basically have everything here except, large-scale grain farms and legume farms. I mean, we're really very lucky to have such a mild climate here on the North Fork.
Mm-hmm. Abra Morawick is talking about how her farm Feisty Acres is surviving the pandemic. This is North Fork Works on WPKN Radio. So to go back to the farms of Europe, it's really heartbreaking. I keep thinking of camembert piling up and being sort of dug into the ground and the milk being poured and the pigs being slaughtered. What will they have learned from this? And at the same time, a related question for you is if you keep expanding and become a very large farm one day, which you may not want to do, but in theory, that is the path that you could be going on. How do you avoid this idea of managing your output?
The biggest lesson that I have learned personally is that your diversity of income really matters. And no matter how big or small of an operation is, it's really important to make sure that you explore all different avenues of income, but never just rely upon one mode of income. You know, most of our income comes from direct to consumer sales. So basically, farmers markets, and when we are open for on-farm pickup, you know, people can come to the farm and buy our goods. But we also used to work with a handful of restaurants. And so we would have, especially during the Memorial Day to Labor Day season, we would have a couple wholesale accounts here on the East End that would offer another mode of income for us. You know, sometimes quail eggs during certain times of the year are harder to move in a farmer's market in New York City because less people are in New York City and more people are out here on the East End. It's really important to be able to have a way to get those eggs to people that are out here on the East End for vacation season. Mm-hmm. So during vacation season, we worked with a handful of restaurants and catering companies. And yes, they would buy 300, 400, you know, quail eggs every week or every 2 weeks from us. And that would offer a secondary mode of income during a certain time of year when one of our other modes tend to be slower, which is July and August. So yes, so our third mode of income is our CSA. And CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And it's a way for people to essentially buy a share into the farm for a season. So you're buying a share of, let's say, poultry and eggs, or just eggs, and you prepay upfront. So you're basically taking a risk with the farmer because you're putting your money up front, just like we put our money up front to purchase chicks and infrastructure and feed. A lot of people buy their CSA shares in January and February, which is another slow time for a lot of farmers here on the East End. But it's also a very essential time of the year for farmers to begin planning and purchasing supplies for the season. And so we offer CSA shares, poultry and egg shares, and then our egg shares as a CSA member every month or every week, depending upon what share you have. June is coming up now, which is going to be our first month of our poultry and egg CSA. And it's a really great way for people who maybe not necessarily want to come to the farm all the time, but still want to have access to local poultry or vegetables or fruit. It's a really good way to force you to learn how to cook certain things that you might not necessarily know how to cook, because CSA shares are generally chosen by the farmer. So we kind of curate the box for you, depending upon what we have during that time of the season. So it also teaches you about how to eat seasonally and what is available season to season, month to month. So between those three modes of income, you know, our farm is pretty well diversified in how we get money at certain times of year.
Even though the products actually don't change that much, birds and eggs, really. Yep, but it's all packaged and moved around in many different ways. Yeah, it's very smart.
We have four different pickup spots Two on the North Fork and two in New York City. We have one in Southold, which is literally right down the street from our farm. It's a local health food store, so it's kind of like a natural match. The man who owns it, his name is Matt, he owns Fit Foods. And we've actually been doing our CSA with him. This will be our third year doing it. We drop off all the shares, all pre-packed with people's names on them, and then they have basically all weekend to come and pick up their shares. And what's nice is that they usually end up buying something in Matt's store because he's got a really nice store. Our other location is in Jamesport at Biophilia Organic Farm. Phil Barbado, the man who owns it and farms that piece of land over there, he runs a certified organic vegetable farm. So people who maybe go and pick up their CSA share in Jamesport, they also buy from him, or they may be CSA members of his farm. And then our two locations in New York City are already two locations that we go to: the Wednesday Union Square Farmers Market and the Saturday Grand Army Plaza Farmers Market in Brooklyn is a local.
I'm fascinated by this idea of growth because the capitalist model assumes growth that never ends. And we've seen what some of the consequences of that are, the negative consequences. Organizations dedicated to endless growth become very clumsy and unwieldy. They're not at all nimble. As circumstances change, they find it difficult to change with the circumstances. And I think
That's
that
right.
is what we've seen. So I just wonder how you think of growth, because also to think of it in the context of the next few months as the grand opening machine starts churning and everything starts opening up again. And we know it's not going to be the same, but something will go back to what it was, or something maybe more like it was than like it is now. I don't know. I'm not in the prediction business. But I just wonder how you think about that from your farm, your perspective, and what you've seen around you.
Well, Chris and I have had a lot of discussions, despite the current circumstances, about how quickly we want to grow, how big do we want to grow, do we want employees? The fact of the matter is we'll probably farm by ourselves for quite a long time, and we'd much prefer it that way because we have absolute 100% control over everything. Not only was it important before COVID-19, but I think it's even more important now. Because we have control over everything, we can make decisions about how and when and where we're going to raise our birds and sell our birds. We might have one employee in a couple years. Two people can do a lot. And if you are actually in it to farm and not be a gentleman farmer or, farm because it's a tax break, but you're farming because that's actually what you want to do for your career, you can do a lot with two people. And I think that Chris and I will be able to grow a pretty substantial amount with just the two of us. I think it's just a matter of us being able to accumulate a few more key resources, such as another vehicle, preferably a van for market, which is something that I'll be working on this year, a tractor with a mower, and then perhaps a small slaughter facility for our birds that we could get inspected by, let's say, Ag and Markets or the USDA. And that way we can really kind of bump up our meat production a little bit more. But
Just a sec, how does that work?
so here in New York State, if you are a poultry farmer and you are raising poultry to process and sell for meat, there's actually three different stages you can fall under. So the first is an on-farm exemption. So if you raise and process between 1 and 1,000 birds in one fiscal year, you are exempt from being inspected either by New York State Ag and Markets or the USDA. Then you can only sell them retail. So that means direct to customer only, CSA, farmers markets, your farm, that's it. No wholesale, no restaurants. You can do 1,001 birds up to 20,000 birds in a fiscal year. But you have to have a facility that is inspected by New York State Ag and Markets. In order to have a facility like this, sometimes you have to spend upwards of $150,000. I think that is something that Chris and I could definitely do in the years to come, but we're not quite there yet. And then as soon as you go over 20,000 birds, markets. You can sell wholesale to restaurants. Mm-hmm. You can obviously sell direct to customer, but you can only sell within New York State.
Mm. If you imagine, you know, yourself being at that second stage, the over 1,000, under 20,000, do you have any concerns that you will lose the sort of the essence of your business, the thing that makes you unique today?
I don't think so. Realistically, I think that Chris and I probably do maximum in a year, probably anywhere between 8,000 and 10,000 birds, let's say, in some far off distant future time. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a big number, but it basically means that you would have to process about 200 birds a week for 52 weeks. That's totally sustainable, and it's absolutely doable, I would say, with 2 to 3 people who are actually farm. Mm. Absolutely. And I think it can be done in a way that is still holds true to the model that we were using. We would just have to acquire a little bit more land, and we would have to probably rethink some of our infrastructure. We would have to rethink, like, let's say, some of our hen houses, make them maybe larger, a little bit more mobile. I think that if you're willing to evolve when you grow, and not only evolve with money in mind, but evolve with your animal's well-being in mind and trying to make sure that you keep that the same, I think it's totally possible. Mm. It has to happen in incremental stages. It can't happen all at once.
And very intentionally. I mean, it happens intentionally, correct. Not randomly. Mm.
So, you know how we were just talking about all of those different stages here in New York State and the numbers? Mm. I hope that with these large centralized meatpacking plants having issues with COVID-19 spread, with workers feeling unsafe, I really hope states like New York State rethink those on-farm processing numbers. Because if people are wanting local meat and local poultry, we are going to have to revolutionize our on-farm processing laws. I think that New York State should begin to allow farmers to process larger amounts of poultry on their farm and be exempt from inspection. I think that's one of the only ways we're ever going to be able to keep up with something like this. And it doesn't have to be a lot. It could even be a small increase, like just let's say 5,000. Mm. Because in order for a farm like us to go to a 5A inspected facility or a USDA inspected facility, I have to travel hours in order to do it.
You know, a lot of what your plans are sort of premised that either this COVID-19 or some other COVID or other virus will be back with us. It's going to be a constant, let's put it that way.
What's happening to the restaurant industry and the food industry in general is extraordinarily heartbreaking to me. However, I can't help but feel that it, not necessarily COVID-19 keeps showing up, but I have a feeling that we will be experiencing disruptions like this perhaps more and more regularly. And it would be unwise if we didn't steel ourselves against disruptions like this happening in the future. And maybe it's not a disease disruption. Perhaps it could be a war disruption or some sort of political disruption. The fact of the matter is food shouldn't be as centralized as it is. If there are disruptions, we should be able, as a population, to be able to access food no matter what. As a citizen and as a farmer, I'm trying to make sure that we set ourselves up for being as durable as possible in any sort of disruption. I do hope that things do go back to normal sooner rather than later. But, you know, Hazel, I'm really unsure. I wish I had a crystal ball.
Yeah. Hey, listen, this is great talking to you, Abra. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Abra Morawick of Feisty Acres. It's been really good to talk to you again.
Thank you. It's been good talking to you, Hazel.
You heard Abra Morawick of Feisty Acres describing how her farm has adapted to the pandemic. You can hear North Fork Works right here on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. All North Fork Works programs are hosted on hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.